In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit,
amen.
Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, that never was it known that anyone who fled to thy protection, implored thy help, or sought thy intercession, was left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, I fly unto thee, O Virgin of Virgins, my Mother. To thee I come, before thee I stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother of the Word Incarnate, despise not my petitions, but in thy mercy hear and answer me. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, it was about a month ago, maybe just a little over a month ago, that regarding this talk, I received my directions from Rome. His Eminence wrote to me and said he asked that I would provide for the Marian Catechists this weekend a catechesis on marriage and the family, with special attention to the questions surrounding so-called homosexual unions or homosexual marriages. So that is what I will attempt to do in today's presentation. And this presentation comes from a compilation of a number of different sources, one that I like to commend to you in particular, and that is the Catholic Answers. How many know about Catholic Answers? It's a very, very good apostolate. It primarily deals with apologetics, but it has done a very, very fine job in regards to the question of same-sex unions. In fact, there is a handout. I believe it's here somewhere. Teresa, I think, has that. You have it? Okay. And we were asked by Bishop Callahan, our diocesan bishop here, to purchase these and attach them to our bulletins, which I did a couple of weeks ago at St. Mary's Parish in Richland Center, and I retrieved some of them, of the bulletins that weren't picked up. So if anyone wants more of these to take and distribute in your parish, you're more than welcome to do that. Also, another very good source that I would commend to you is the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops, their website. They have done really some very, very excellent work in regards to the question of so-called same-sex marriage. Also, too, the Ruth Institute. How many have heard of the Ruth Institute? It's a very, very good institute that works diligently in defending traditional marriage and the nuclear family, the traditional family. And then also, of course, servant of God, Father John Harden. His catechism here, I believe, is available to you, his catechism on homosexuality. So I would commend these to you. I might mention there is the Catholic Answers. I didn't have time. I actually retrieved this, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday, in a box that I had things stored in upstairs. I knew I had something from Catholic Answers, and I didn't have enough time to tell Teresa to get it for you, but it is kind of an in-depth, it's called a special report. It's entitled Gay Marriage, in quotation marks, and it's from Catholic Answers. And I would highly recommend this to you. It was written back in 2004, but it has superb references to many sociological studies regarding the effects of, first of all, behavior within the same-sex community, as well as especially the raising of children headed by a household of same-sex couples. So, and it works in a kind of a question and answer format. So I would recommend this to you. I don't particularly like this, and they do have it in quotations mark, gay marriage. Maybe I'll just start with that I don't, in my pastoral work and even in just ordinary conversations, I don't use the word gay. And I don't think we should use the word gay. Gay really means something else, something delightful, and it's been kind of taken over by the same-sex attracted community. I believe that we should use the word person when we describe a person with a same-sex attraction. I always try to use the word a person with a same-sex attraction, or a person with homosexual tendencies, or you can call it a homosexual person. But I think we need to use the word person Because person is ultimately what defines us, not our gender. We are created in the image and the likeness of God first and foremost. And our personhood comes from God. And as I will mention here also too, our gender comes from God. But for a person to be identified only by a particular sexual orientation, I think sells that person short. So I'll just commend that to you. So now the presentation. Perhaps the best place to start with this reflection on marriage is with the human person, with what is known as theological anthropology. Marriage is a unique relationship between two specific persons, one man and one woman. Men and women are created in the image of God. This means that they have great dignity and worth. And we know from the first epistle of St. John, the fourth chapter, the eighth verse, that God is love. And since God is love, each person created in God's image finds his or her fulfillment by loving others. Also, men and women are body persons. The body, male or female, is an essential part of being human. Gender is not an afterthought or a mere social construct. The body shapes what it means to love as a human person. When we think about marriage, we must think about who the human person is, created with great dignity and called to love as a body person, male and female. Gaudium et Spes in paragraph 48 states, God himself is the author of marriage. When God created human persons in his own image as male and female, he placed in their hearts the desire and the task to love, to give themselves totally to another person. Marriage is one of two ways someone can make a total gift of oneself. The other is virginity, devoting oneself entirely to God. And yesterday, in the Cardinal's presentation, we know that that, in fact, was embraced by our Blessed Mother Mary. Marriage is not something thought up by human society or by any religion. Rather, it comes from who the human person is as male and female. And society and religion affirm and reinforce this. The truth of marriage is therefore available to everyone, regardless of their religious beliefs or lack thereof. Both faith and reason speak to the true meaning of marriage. Now, this definition of marriage comes to us from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 1601, also from Canon 1055, and from Gaudium et Spes, paragraph 48. Marriage is the lifelong partnership of mutual and exclusive fidelity between a man and a woman, ordered by its very nature to the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children. The bond of marriage, that's close quote, the bond of marriage is indissoluble. That is, it lasts until death brings it to an end. At the heart of married love is the total gift of self that husband and wife freely offer to each other. Because of their sexual difference, husband and wife can truly become one flesh and can give to each other the reality of children who are a living reflection of their love. That reality of children who are a living reflection of the love is a quote from Familiaris Consortio, number 14. Marriage between a baptized man and a baptized woman is a sacrament. This means that the bond between husband and wife is a visible sign of the sacrificial love of Christ for his church. As a sacrament, marriage gives spouses the grace they need to love each other generously in imitation of Christ. The word marriage isn't simply a label that can be attached to different types of relationships. Instead, marriage reflects a deep reality, the reality of a unique, fruitful, lifelong union that is only possible between a man and a woman. Sexual difference is essential to marriage. And the attempt to redefine marriage to include two persons of the same sex denies the reality of what marriage is. Sexual difference is the difference of man to woman and woman to man. It affects a person at every level of his or her existence, genetically, biologically, emotionally, psychologically, and socially. It is unlike any other difference we experience, because it, and only it, allows for the total personal union between husband and wife that is at the heart of marriage. The difference between men and women is for the sake of their union with each other. It is what makes spousal union possible. The commitment of marriage is properly described as a communion, where two become one flesh. Only a man and a woman in marriage can become a one flesh communion. The unity of husband and wife is so intimate that from it can come another unique and unrepeatable person, a child, a new life. No other relationship, no matter how loving or committed, can have this unique form of commitment, this kind of communion that exists in marriage between a husband and a wife. My identity as a person, that is my I, is inseparable from the reality of my body. I am a body person. As Blessed John Paul II pointed out, the body reveals the person. It is a deeply personal reality, not just a biological fact. The body is, we might say, included into every human action, including the most important act of all, loving another person. Loving as a human person means loving as a man or as a woman. Marriage, which is described in Gaudium et Spes as the primary form of human love, necessarily involves the reality of men and women as body persons. Marriage is intrinsically opposite sex. To dismiss the body and gender as unimportant to marriage means treating the body as inconsequential or as an object to be used according to one's pleasure, instead of as an essential aspect of being human and of being essential for loving as a human being. The love between a husband and wife involves a free, total, and faithful gift of self that not only expresses love, but also opens the spouses to accept the gift of a child. No other human interaction on earth is like this. This is why sexual intimacy is reserved exclusively for married love. Marriage is the only relationship wherein sexual relations between a man and a woman can be expressed as a true gift of the self. On the other hand, sexual behavior between two men or two women can never reach the oneness experienced between husband and wife, nor can these acts bring forth new life. It is impossible for two persons of the same sex to make a total gift of self to each other as a husband and a wife do, bodily and personally. Homosexual acts are harmful and always wrong, and are incapable of authentically expressing conjugal love. Love which by its nature includes the capacity to give oneself fully to the other, and to receive the other as gift, in a communion of body, mind, and spirit. No relationship between two persons of the same sex can ever be held up as equal or analogous to the relationship between a husband and a wife. What is missing fundamentally in a same-sex relationship is what is known as sexual complementarity. Complementarity refers to the unique relationship between men and women that bind the two of them together as a one-flesh communion and that brings about the birth of a new human being. It is from this complementarity that the two ends of marriage come forth, namely the unity of spouses and the procreation of children. And I wish to comment on each of these two ends of marriage. First, the unitive end, and then the procreative. Without complementariness, the human person would be unfulfilled and perpetually unhappy. Thus the observation recorded in the book of Genesis. It is not good for the man to be alone. And here I want to refer to and read from part of this special report from Catholic Answers, which I think puts this forward very, very well. The Russian existentialist philosopher Nicholas Berdyaev tried to explain the need for sexual complementarity by saying that loneliness is part of the human condition, and that loneliness occurs because deep down we all realize that neither a man by himself nor a woman by herself is biologically completely human. Each lacks the perfections and capabilities of the opposite sex. And in that sense, each is incomplete and lonely without the other. Men and women are different and in many ways complementary. The differences between man and woman are obvious to all but the most ideologically blinded deconstructionists. Men and women have been found by psychologists in every culture to differ in aggression and general activity level, types of cognitive strength, sensory sensitivity, and sexual behavior. These differences matter both spiritually and physically, for without the complementarity between a man and a woman on all these levels, the deepest forms of union are not possible. The unity possible to two men or two women will be necessarily lopsided, both spiritually and anatomically, and therefore ultimately unsatisfying. Two men together cannot capture the fullness of human personhood, and neither can two women. For that, you need one man and one woman. However, exclusive, unconditional, and permanent same-sex relationships may aspire to be, they lack the complementarity that the deepest fulfillment requires. This fact may explain some of the amazing sexual behavior in the homosexual subculture. Complementarity is also makes possible the procreative end of marriage. In marriage, the complementarity of husband and wife is expressed in the act of conjugal love that brings forth new life. Children are at the very heart of marriage. Gaudi Mitzvahs in paragraph 50 describes the child as the supreme gift of marriage. It is only because of their sexual difference that spouses are able to cooperate with God in bringing a child into this world. Now, complementariness does not end with conception and birth, but it is greatly present in fathering and mothering. Actions that call for the collaboration and the unique gifts of a husband and a wife. Because men and women are complementary, they bring different gifts to a relationship. Only a woman can be a mother. Only a man can be a father. Each contributes in a distinct and unique way to the formation of children, helping them to understand their identity as male or female. Respecting a child's dignity means affirming his or her need for and right to a mother and a father. One of the grave injustices present in same-sex households is the denial of a child's right to be parented in the fullest sense of the word, to be parented by the unique gifts brought to their lives by a male father and a female mother. Another good description of this complementariness in parenting is again set forth in this special report of Catholic Answers, and I want to share that with you. There seem to be good reasons that children need both biological parents. The sexes are different. Because gender is a real phenomenon, it should come as no surprise that men and women parent differently. Men and women bring different complementary skills to child rearing. Men are more likely to play expansively with their children than do mundane caretaking. Women tend to be more practical. Mothers tend to emphasize the emotional security of their children, while fathers tend to stress competition and risk-taking. Mothers tend to seek the immediate well-being of the child, while fathers tend to foster long-term autonomy and independence. Children need both parents because they learn different lessons from each. Neither fathers nor mothers are expendable. The presence of a father is critical to a male child's learning self-control and appropriate male behavior, especially learning to respect women. Similarly, the presence of a father is vital for a female child's self-respect and eventual development of healthy adult sexuality. And I might mention that all of these statements are footnoted with sociological studies that, as I mentioned, this report is very good in bringing forth. Children need mothers just as much. The presence of both parents seem to be necessary for ideally balanced emotional and mental development. Put in technical psychological jargon, the social science evidence suggests that women teach children communion. That means the drive towards inclusion, connectedness, and relationship, and that men teach children agency, the drive toward independence, individuality, and self-fulfillment. Further, children of both sexes appear to learn self-control and responsibility primarily from their father. They fail to learn them when he's not involved in their lives. Our national epidemic of fatherlessness has spawned an epidemic of antisocial children. Marriage, for all these reasons, is a major public health issue and not just a private affair. Marriages that are exclusive, permanent, unconditional, and life-giving contribute much to public health and longevity. Marriages that fail any of these criteria and end in divorce create an enormous social, emotional, and health care burden for the couple, their children, and society. Children, then, deserve to have their need for a father and a mother respected and protected in law. And these laws have existed in the past, but in our present day they are being undermined and eroded. And while it is true that a child is meant to be raised by his or her own married father and mother, there are times when, due to family tragedies or other unfortunate circumstances, this cannot happen. The Church acknowledges the difficulties faced by single parents and seeks to support them as they meet the needs of their children. There is a big difference, however, between the unintended reality of single parenthood and approving the formation of alternative families that deliberately deprive a child of a father or a mother, such as arrangements headed by two men or two women. Undesired single parenthood can still witness to the importance of sexual difference by acknowledging the challenges faced by single parents and their children due to the lack of a father or mother. In contrast, arrangements of two men or two women are incapable of such witness and present motherhood and fatherhood as disposable. The Church teaches that the proper mission of husband and wife is having children and raising them. That having been said, spouses are never to use each other in order to have a child. And a marriage not blessed with children are fruitful through the spouse's mutual gift of self and their loving service to others. A child is not some kind of a product. but rather a gift from God, a human person with great dignity and worth. Only a man and woman are able to conceive a child through each other. And even when a husband and wife do not in fact conceive a child due to infertility or age, their sexual acts are still the kind of acts by which children are naturally conceived. In contrast, two persons of the same sex may be perfectly healthy, but will never be able to unite in such a way that a child is conceived. This is an important point to be noted, in that when it is pointed out that the primary end of marriage is the procreation of children, it is often argued by those who are in favor of same-sex unions that infertile couples are being judged to be unworthy of marriage in the same unfair way that same-sex couples are being judged. However, there is not an equivalence in these two situations. There are many stories where couples who have given up on having children due to infertility or perceived infertility were completely surprised when they conceived a child. And we know, for example, from the book of Genesis that Sarah, the wife of Abraham, was 90 years of age when she gave birth to Isaac. With God, all things are possible. This can never happen, though, in a same-sex union, in that the sexual act is thoroughly and completely disordered. It is biologically impossible for conception to take place through a homosexual act. And on this point, God cannot bring forth a miracle as he can with an infertile man or woman or an elderly couple, in that miracles begin with the natural order of creation. As grace builds on nature, miracles begin with a nature that is governed by laws. If it were to be God's will for there to be a miracle, such miracles supersede the laws of nature, laws that come forth from the Creator. The homosexual act thoroughly contradicts God's wisdom that is present in His creation. It is an unnatural act that is chosen by the person who engages in that act. Now here the church makes a distinction between the orientation of the person with the same-sex attraction, which is not necessarily chosen. There is an ongoing debate among psychologists as whether a person is born with this particular cross or whether it's something that comes to the person through their culture or through their environment, especially when they are very young. So that is inconclusive as to whether it's nature or nurture by which a person comes to realize these same-sex attractions within them. So there's a distinction between the orientation that the person finds within themselves and the actions that come about which are chosen because of the attraction. And here is made the classic distinction that we are to love the sinner but to hate the sin. We can and should love persons who experience the cross of a same-sex attraction. However, we cannot in any way accept the perverted acts that are chosen because of this attraction. Another distinction that catechists should be aware of and be able to make when conversing with persons with same-sex attractions, and perhaps even more so with their parents and other family members, has to do with the claim that is frequently repeated that God has created persons to have homosexual attractions. And because everything God creates is good, then homosexuality must be considered to be a good. It is true that everything God creates is good, most especially each and every human being. As indicated at the beginning of this talk, all human beings are created in God's image and likeness. That being the truth, it is also a truth that all human beings, except our Lord and our Blessed Mother Mary, inherit the consequences of the fall from grace of our first parents. While not totally corrupted by the fall from grace, our human nature has been seriously injured in various ways whereby we can be born with physical, psychological, and emotional anomalies or defects. Same-sex attraction is an abnormality that is a consequence of the sin of our first parents. It is false to claim that God has created human beings with same-sex attractions. And this is a truth that has to be explained with great sensitivity, but with firmness, especially to family members of persons with same-sex attractions. And you perhaps have come across this, I certainly have, where parents will suddenly turn against the church and the teaching of the church in a very quick and almost violent way when one of their children comes to them and reveals to them that they have this same-sex attraction, and now they're becoming involved in the homosexual culture and so forth. And the parents are saying, well, you know, God created my son, was involved in creating my daughter. And so this is part of that creation. Of course, it is not. No matter how returning for a moment to the procreative end of marriage, there are those who will maintain that modern technology has begun to replace the need for two physical human beings engaging in a conjugal act in order to bring forth human life. And so this concern of the church that a married man and woman is needed for procreation is becoming more and more irrelevant. No matter how powerful reproductive technology becomes, the fact will always remain that two men or two women can never become parents through each other. They will always depend on the donation of someone else's sperm or egg in order to bring about the birth of a child. Children conceived in this artificial way are always and intentionally separated from either their father or their mother, sometimes even both. Furthermore, using technology such as in vitro fertilization means that conception does not take place within the loving embrace of husband and wife, but instead is a dehumanized act of production, a mere putting together of the parents' genetic material. No child should be treated as a product. A child deserves to come forth from an act of love, the fruit of his or her parents' mutual loving self-gift. Now I'd like to consider some of the more frequent objections to the church's teaching which prohibits same-sex union and actively opposes so-called same-sex marriages. One of the most effective arguments used by the same-sex movement is that it is a matter of discrimination for same-sex couples to be denied marriage and the material benefits that accompany marriage. This is a most effective argument here in the United States in that we celebrate the fact that we are a nation where unjust discrimination is redressed. Treating different things differently is not unjust discrimination. Treating different things differently is not unjust discrimination. Marriage, as I've said, can only be between a man and a woman. There is nothing else like it. Only a man and a woman are capable of giving themselves to each other so that the two become one flesh. And only a man and a woman are capable of sexual activity that brings forth the birth of a child. So the government has a very correct and strong interest in protecting the right of children to belong to their biological mothers and fathers, and in reducing the likelihood that these children will become dependents or wards of the state. The civil law of marriage serves both these interests by legally bonding adult couples to each other and to any children that they might bring forth into the world. The sexual activity of two persons of the same sex never brings forth children. So the civil laws can be and should be somewhat disinterested in supporting same-sex couples. The civil law is reasonable and in no way unjust in distinguishing between two persons of the same sex and an opposite sex couple when conferring the right to legal marriage. Another objection that is often raised is that in not allowing two men or two women to marry is simply a repeat of past discrimination when interracial couples were sometimes forbidden to marry. There is no valid analogy between the goal of redefining marriage to include persons of the same sex and the historical movement to allow interracial couples to marry. The sexual relations between a man and a woman are simply not the same as the sexual relations between two men or between two women, regardless of their ethnicity. The intimate acts of husband and wife are able to unite them fully and to enable them to welcome children. Sexual difference is an essential characteristic of marriage. Ethnic sameness or difference is not. Marriage is rooted in nature. Two people of the same sex are no more being denied the right to marry than a man, that is, a male, is being denied the right to be able to give birth to a child. Authentic human rights flow from our human nature, and that nature includes sexual difference. Another matter that is a concern for the church is how a redefinition of marriage will affect the religious liberty of those who oppose such redefinition as a matter of conscience. I think we're all aware of the debate that has taken place regarding the Health and Human Services mandate, the Obamacare, and the attack and the danger to religious liberty by requiring people of conscience to violate their conscience in providing means of sterilization and contraception and abortifacients. A redefinition of marriage will only further erode religious liberty in our nation. Changing the legal term marriage is not simply one change in the law, but rather amounts to thousands of changes at once. And this is pointed out by the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops. The term marriage can be found in family law, employment law, trusts and estates, healthcare law, tax law, property law, and many others. These laws affect and in many instances regulate religious institutions such as churches, religiously affiliated schools, hospitals, and families. When church and state agree on what the legal term marriage means, the union of one man and one woman, there is a harmony between the civil law and religious institutions, which is what you hope for in a nation. When church and state disagree on what the term marriage means, conflict will result between the law and religious institutions, as the state will apply various sanctions against the church for its refusal to comply with the state's definition. Some of the sanctions could be court orders compelling action, whereby the government forces religious institutions to retain as leaders, employees, or members those who engage in a legalized same-sex marriage. The government will eventually force religious institutions to extend any special benefit that they afford to actual marriage to same-sex marriage as well. It is simply a matter of time when preaching the gospel, political action, or even conversation reflecting moral opposition to same-sex marriage will be judged to be harassment or hate speech. It is predicted that those who adhere to the biblical definition of marriage will be excluded from participation in highly regulated professions and quasi-governmental functions, as licenses are revoked and religious institutions lose accredited status. Also, those who hold to the biblical definition of marriage will be excluded from receiving government grants and contracts to provide social services, as well as being denied various tax exemptions. Some of these concerns just mentioned have already come to pass. Examples include, but are not limited to, the following. Legal action taken this year against a Catholic high school for firing a teacher in a same-sex relationship. This took place in Ohio. A florist who declined to provide flowers for a same-sex wedding was sued by the Attorney General of the state of Washington in this year. Last year in Vermont, a bed and breakfast owner who declined to host a reception for a same-sex wedding had to pay $30,000 and agree to never host wedding receptions again. In the state of New York, a Catholic hospital was sued by an employee for not providing health insurance for the employee's same-sex spouse. Last year in Maryland, a university administrator was placed on administrative leave for signing a petition to place on a state ballot a law that would support traditional marriage. Last year, here in Wisconsin at Shawano High School, a student was threatened with suspension for writing a school newspaper op-ed opposing adoption by persons of the same sex. Last year in Michigan, a counseling student was expelled for requesting not to counsel persons in a same-sex relationship. In the state of Maine, public notaries have been told by state officials that if they perform any weddings, they must provide wedding services to persons in same-sex relationships or face a human rights violation. And Catholic Charities in Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., and Illinois were refused funding and the necessary licenses to provide adoptions and or foster care for refusal to place children with same-sex couples. And these threats are found not only here in the United States, but in other countries as well. And in fact, in some countries, in even more extreme ways. I'd like to just add one more reflection before concluding. And this actually came from a discussion this morning when some of us were having breakfast over at the Holy Cross Diocesan Center. And there it was stated in the discussion that a person said they really didn't see that same-sex marriage, allowing same-sex couples to be involved in marriage, really should threaten marriage, that somehow they could exist parallel alongside each other. And I'm kind of using my own words to describe, but I don't want to say that was everything that was in the person's mind who was sharing this. And I just simply don't believe that this is true. Anytime we have done something that directly affects marriage, marriage has always been weakened. You think of contraception. Pope Paul VI, he predicted that marriages would be weakened if contraception was legalized. Think of no-fault divorce, of the disaster that has brought about in terms of marriages. And those are kind of, the no-fault divorce is an attack on the permanence of marriage. The contraception is an attack on the fertility, the fruitfulness of marriage. But now with this, this is not just an attack on some aspect of marriage. This is a redefining of marriage, a complete new retooling and historical understanding of marriage that we've never, ever seen before. That, in my mind, points out that there is a great danger to marriage, and that for us to kind of somewhat be passive and say, well, let there be kind of these parallel experiences, you know, that there's marriage for same-sex couples, and then there is biblical marriage or Christian marriage. There's also, I read an interesting, when preparing for this, I forget the name of the Monsignor, he's from the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., and he had a very interesting recommendation. He said that we in the church should stop using the word marriage now, and we should use the word matrimony. And I thought about it, and actually in some cases now I speak about matrimony more often than I did marriage. But, you know, and he pointed out that his ordinary he put this on his blog. He said that his ordinary said that he doesn't, and he thinks that the church should officially embrace this. And but his ordinary said, no, you know, don't be pushing in that direction. And I would agree with his ordinary that I don't think we should give up marriage. You know, we gave up the word gay. I mean, that's lost, you know. And now to somehow say, well, we'll assign marriage for these kinds of unions over there, and then as Christians, we'll hang on to matrimony. I don't think that's a good idea. I think we have to fight as difficult as the fight is going to be, and is, we have to fight for the integrity of the word and the term marriage. It belongs to God, and it belongs to the reality of marriage. In conclusion, marriage protects and promotes the dignity of men and women, the dignity of children, and the dignity of all persons in society. First, the lifelong partnership of marriage is the only place where men and women can truly express authentic sexual love, love that is total, faithful, permanent, and open to children. Only within marriage can sexual relations mean what they are supposed to mean as an expression of self-giving love between a man and a woman. The promises of a husband and wife invite a high level of mutual trust that sex will not be exploitative, but will manifest true union and life-giving love. Marriage provides a context within which the rights of children to a mother and father are legally protected. Marriage also helps assure that children will be welcomed as a gift from God. And finally, the family, founded on marriage, is a place where a person can exist for his or her own sake. So much is at stake at this time in the history of our nation and our world. More than ever, we need courageous men and women equipped with the truth of the gospel to stop the sexual perversion that seeks to be enshrined in our laws, and in turn to promote the dignity, the beauty, and the truth of marriage and family life. May the Marian Catechist Apostolate be involved in fostering and equipping such courageous women and men. Thank you.